You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Kevin McLenathan.
And I'm Sarah Welch Larson.
So, Sarah, in the buddy comedy that is Seeing and Believing, which one of us would you say is the by-the-book straight man, and which one of us is the loose cannon who plays by their own rules?
Well, you did say straight man, and you are a man, and the loose cannon has no gender, so I'm going to assume that I am the loose cannon, and you must be the straight man.
Fair enough. I can't argue with that. Listeners, we are going to be talking about two buddy movies on this week's episode. First up is a film from the Indian film industry we've heard so much about. We're looking forward to digging into it on this week's episode. That is S.S. Rajamouli's RRR.
And then we're going to keep on with the buddy dynamic by watching a, not really buddy cop, but maybe buddy detective movie. We're going to be covering Shane Black's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in the watch list.
Are we going to get some bickering odd couple energy going on in this week's episode?
I mean, I could bicker. I'm capable of bickering. We'll see if we can get a good bicker going.
Well, we'll see how that goes on this week's episode, episode 342 of Seeing and Believing. Yes, we're here on episode 342 of Seeing and Believing, and I just want to take this opportunity right now, Sarah, to say thank you for becoming the other half of the odd couple for this podcast. We've got a little bit of... I don't know if we bicker quite as much as the heroes of a stereotypical Shane Black buddy comedy, but,
we'll get there eventually.
Eventually, we'll get to that sort of odd couple dynamic. But for now, we'll keep things, civil, collegial, all that good stuff. We are going to be talking about a Shane Black comedy a little bit later on in the show with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. So I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts on that movie. But I'm looking forward even more to getting your thoughts about the movie here in this first half. So this is a movie that you and I, we both were hearing a lot about earlier in the year when it first came out. It's an Indian film, so it didn't get quite the kind of huge release that an American film, an English language film, would be getting, obviously. But even so, its reputation kind of preceded it. And I can say, it's that kind of word of mouth is probably justified.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah, I think so.
So the movie we're talking about here is RRR, a.k.a. Rise, Roar, Revolt. It's a three-hour Indian epic directed by S.S. Rajamouli about two men, Raju, an officer with the Colonial British Police Force, and Beam, the champion of a forest tribe, who's on a mission to recover one of his village's girls, who has been kidnapped by the wickedest British people this side of Braveheart. The two become fast friends during a daring rescue, not realizing that Beam is the very person whom Raju has pledged to hunt down for his British superiors. Twists, turns, action, and music and dance ensue as their fraught relationship leads to an outright violent conflict with their British colonizers. So, I mean, I feel like that synopsis maybe covers the first third of the movie, first half maybe. There's a lot going on in this movie. It's got a lot going on. And Sarah, you and I, we were talking about this before the show began. Neither of us is what I would call an expert on Indian movies, Bollywood movies. I think I've seen only a handful. And so for me, at least, watching RRR was a journey in kind of entering a world with completely different cinematic conventions. And I'm really curious to maybe get us started with a conversation on that theme. What was it like for you, since you're kind of in a similar space with me about Indian films, what was it like for you entering into those completely different cinematic conventions and sensibilities? And how did that affect your overall experience with the movie?
Yeah, it's funny because I think this movie feels like there's been a lot of hype and a lot of like talking it up as this is the wildest movie you're ever going to see, especially this year. And knowing that I don't know a ton about Bollywood or Tollywood, because this is a Tollywood movie, knowing that I don't know a ton about that, I think I went in with a little bit of trepidation, not because I was intimidated by the subject matter or anything like that, but knowing that I'm coming in basically completely blank, no cultural background, very little understanding of a lot of the stuff that's going to be alluded to in this movie. And I think the nice thing is this is definitely a movie that teaches you how to watch it as you're watching it, which I appreciated quite a bit. And the way that it teaches you to do that is to just go pedal to the metal nonstop the entire time. It was kind of refreshing to engage with a movie that just has completely different movie making conventions. The camera moves a little bit differently. Different emotions and reactions like get a little bit more or less like reaction time, depending on what's going on screen. It feels like there's a heavy emphasis on rule of cool that is very much like and yet completely unlike what Michael Bay would do necessarily. And I don't know, it was refreshing and it was a little bit intimidating. And I had a blast watching this movie. I don't know about you.
I'm curious, before I give my reaction, you mentioned the phrase rule of cool. You want to elaborate a little bit on what you mean by that?
If it looks cool on screen, you do it.
Okay. Yeah. Because I think that's definitely a rule that this movie follows. Mm-hmm. If there is something that's going to do just really just amp up the stakes in any way it can, Rajamouli does that thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a similar place with you in that there's an audacity to this movie that obviously I can't speak to how audacious it is relative to other movies from that region, mm-hmm. but I can say that in comparison to the kinds of blockbusters that we're getting in American multiplexes, it's audacious.
Yes.
This is the sort of movie that we don't even get the title card until almost 45 minutes into the runtime, because mm-hmm. Rajamouli is going to set up each of the main characters with their own extended action sequence. And then he's going to have them come together in another extended action sequence where they work together. And then that's when the movie starts.
Yes.
And that, I think, is just that kind of maximalist approach to character and also to storytelling that I really appreciated. This is not what I would call a super complex film, but it's very savvy in the way that it makes the characters very clear from the outset. We know each of them pretty well. We know what they want. Mm-hmm. We know what they don't want. Their emotional connection is made crystal clear from the very outset. And when those things are established, you can really, the sky's the limit. And the movie just takes off running with those, and the ways that it finds to play with those emotional dynamics makes for something that's really satisfying on an action movie level, and also just in terms of an emotional level. Like, it gets its hooks into you, and it knows kind of how to play this interpersonal dynamic for maximum drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Melodrama isn't quite the right word for this, because I don't think it's working on like a melodramatic like scale or anything, but it does seem to be interested in upping the stakes personally and professionally for all of these characters involved at every single possible moment. And that feels like one of those hallmarks of melodrama, but it's not really that either. And I had a hard time kind of categorizing this movie in my head, because there is a lot of like action, adventure, romance, a little bit of mystery involved, definitely like a little bit of buddy cop almost dynamic in between Beam and Raju. I don't know. It kind of feels like it's so maximalist that you almost can't quantify it or classify it into any one specific genre. It doesn't feel like it fits neatly into any of those slots. So I know on your letterbox, you actually described this kind of as like Battleship Potemkin-esque mm-hmm. a little bit. And we can get into that a little bit more later. I would argue it's almost more Top Gun than anything else, because it's kind of in that similar vein of over the top, like kind of nationalistic storytelling that is also very much revolving around the relationship between two characters who are polar opposites to each other. So I'm curious to know your read on
that. So I made the Battleship Potemkin comparison mostly because, this is a very nationalistic movie. I mm-hmm. don't think it's unfair to say that it functions very well as propaganda. And I don't mean propaganda in any sort of derogatory sense. I mean that purely descriptively, in that it's very interested in getting you hyped up to see the Indian guys beat the bad guys.
Yes.
And I think that that's something that Battleship Potemkin does as well. It's really interested in just making you want to cheer for the revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, Battleship Potemkin has that in spades. This movie has it in spades. That said, it's a very good point that you make that it's not like Potemkin, in that Potemkin doesn't really have a protagonist per se.
There's a veneer of like historicity to Potemkin, I think.
Right. It's very, you get very invested in the revolution succeeding in Potemkin, but you don't really have a personal connection to any individual character in Potemkin in the way that you do here. And I think comparing it to Top Gun crystallizes that a little bit, because it is about kind of, you know, the nationalistic fervor and wanting to see these evil colonizers get their comeuppance and to, you know, have these freedom fighters succeed in fighting for freedom.
Yeah.
But it also wants you to care about these two guys. And I think the attention it lavishes on them kind of just being bros is, I think, maybe the better part of the move, or the part of the movie that I really connected with. There's a whole act of the movie that's devoted to Beam. He's kind of developed feelings for a British woman named Jenny. Mm-hmm. And Raju just spends a good, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes of the film just being the best wingman in the universe and getting these two crazy lovebirds together. And that's just a lot of fun to watch, even if it doesn't necessarily have a whole, like, she's more a plot device than a person. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have a whole lot to do with the main, like, the main plot thread of the film, but it's fun, and it leads to the best song and dance number of the entire film. So for my money, it's worth it.
Yeah, their relationship's a little bit more of a means to an end, because like once you have access to her, you have access to the entire British compound, which allows you to like launch your sneak attack, which we will talk about, because that's an incredible action
sequence. We will.
But I would argue that it does have more like function than just the plot, because I think it's not just about these two characters like being the best bros that they possibly can be in order to like get one of them introduced to a girl. I think it also really helps to serve to strengthen their relationship to each other as well. And that's definitely the more important relationship throughout the entire movie. Like, it's not just that Raju wants Beam to like succeed at getting the ladies or anything like that. That kind of feels secondary to the entire plot. All of these characters do have love interests, but they're definitely more of like connective tissue to other parts of the story. Like, Jenny is a good way to get into the compound. Raju has a love interest back home who kind of keeps him, like, reminds him who he's fighting for, essentially. But the real important relationship is between these two characters. And I think a strength of the movie is that relationship gets strengthened even when these two guys are also off, like, pursuing their other respective interests, if that makes any sense. Like, that dance sequence where the two basically just dance the Brits into the dirt is absolutely delightful, because it's just so joyous, and it's so defiant in the face of the elitism that the colonizers are like trying to display over the people that they've colonized. Like, there's a character who comes up to Beam and basically challenges him to a dance off and says like, can you dance all of these different ways that I can? And he's incredibly disrespectful as he does it. Like, he even goes so far as to shove his foot into Beam's face. And Raju comes in and just sort of like breaks everything apart, starts playing the drums like on a really sick beat, honestly. And then the two of them just dance everybody else at the party that they're at into the ground, and then they proceed to compete with each other. And I think that there's a line that's kind of, it feels like the linchpin of this entire movie, where one of them looks at the other and says like, I looked you in the face and I knew that I wanted to compete with you. And that level of competition and friendly rivalry, like being channeled towards also fighting for freedom, is something that, like, I don't know, it's an interesting tension, because it's not necessarily at odds with each other, but I think it does introduce some interesting friction in interesting ways, because the two of them have extremely different methods in their freedom fighting. And a lot of the conflict in the story isn't necessarily just we're fighting against the British. It's also we're fighting against the British in very different ways and have different philosophies about that. And I think that plus their friendship is really fascinating storytelling.
I mean, if that's a linchpin bit of dialogue, I would add that the linchpin kind of image is during at the culmination of that first big action sequence with both of them. It's the thing that leads into the title card. They've swung on the same piece of rope from opposite sides of a bridge so that they kind of swing towards each other and meet in the middle on the underside of the bridge. Mm-hmm. And they grasp each other's forearms, sort of like stop their swinging. Mm-hmm. And that sort of like each of them grasping the other's forearm with one arm is an image both of fraternal respect and support, but it's also the way that it focuses just on their muscles and the grip. It also there's a little bit of adversarial tenor to that as well. And that's maybe the heart of the film as well, is that they are as they describe each other later on in the film, they're best friends. And yet the differing ways that they seek to achieve their goals puts them in conflict with each other. And that's also kind of that is a different note to play in their relationship that makes it, you know, so it's not all just fun time, you know, dancing people into the dirt over in RRR land. It's also they have very serious goals, and both of them can't win in that, or at least in the first half of the film, both of them can't win. And I actually kind of want to talk about the construction of this film, because it's easy, I think, when we talk about this movie to make it sound as if it's sort of like, oh, it's just throwing everything at the wall. There's like dance numbers and there's action sequences and there's romance and mystery. And it makes it sound kind of slapdash, but I think that's actually pretty clever about how it structures itself so that you really understand Beam from the beginning, sort of like what his goal is. Mm-hmm. And something that you kind of don't fully appreciate about Raju is why he's so devoted to being the best cop he can be.
Yeah.
And the revelation for his reasoning behind that, I think, is a really strong moment of the film. And the fact that Rajamouli withholds that until the point in the film that he does, mm-hmm, is a large reason for this movie working the way it does. It doesn't, it's a long movie, but you kind of are pulled through it by just wanting to know why is this character the way he is? And when that revelation finally arrives, you kind of wonder, okay, well, what is this character going to do in order to achieve those goals? I'm being mm-hmm purposely vague because I don't want to spoil that revelation, mm-hmm, but I think it's really a strong one.
Yeah, I think a lot of the criticism that I've heard and read lately about this movie kind of treats it as like a dude's rock sort of movie. And I mm-hmm think, like you'd said, that kind of implies a little bit of haphazardness to the construction. And this movie is very carefully constructed in order to draw like the most possible drama and the most like the highest possible stakes out of every single revelation, every single character interaction. You meet both of these characters and you know who they are individually right at the very beginning, but you don't understand their individual motivations necessarily until those revelations are made. And I think it's crucial that Beam's motivation is made right after both characters have been introduced, and Raju's motivation isn't introduced until right after the intermission. But in between all of that, there's kind of this repeated refrain of both of them grasping arms with each other. And sometimes it's adversarial and sometimes it's in play. And then sometimes it's in genuine like teamwork. So they're grasping forearms at one point. At one point during a montage, they're actually like playing tug of war with each other and with a group of other kids from their city. And then at one point, they're sort of dangling from a precipice. And some big revelations have been made about both of them at that moment in time. And they're essentially like depending on each other for their lives. And they also just want to let the other go, and they can't do it because their bond is just so strong. And that isn't necessarily alluded to in the dialogue at all. It's purely the image. And I think that that's a mark of a really strong movie, is that it can get all of that information across without having to beat you over the head with it, because there's plenty of other things that it can afford to be over the top about, but not that particular piece of imagery. I think it's strong enough that it just carries through the rest of the movie.
It kind of makes me wish now that, that I couldn't have picked this movie for the watchlist, because I think you've already seen it, but it kind of makes me wish that we had watched Heat mm-hmm for the watchlist segment, because it's exactly the same sort of dynamic. Two men, and they're always, you know, they're man is a very masculine director, and this is a very masculine film in its turn. But the, you know, two men on opposite sides who just, they know that the other person is the only one who truly understands what they're going through, even when they're locked in deadly conflict.
You just got at why I love Heat. I adore Heat. I haven't met a Michael Mann movie I didn't like, honestly, but Heat is feels like it's one of the pinnacles there.
I mean, and it's telling too that the final image of Heat is two men grasping hands.
Yes.
And I've kind of really want to watch Heat right now. But I mean, that kind of sensibility is the same, even though Mann is, in terms of his aesthetic, is very different from Rajamouli here. I want to talk, like, let's get into that aesthetic a little bit more. You mentioned there's an action sequence in this movie.
Yes.
That is far and away the best action sequence I've seen all year. And I kind of want to talk about it in detail, and I also don't want to talk about it because I don't want to spoil it for the listeners. But suffice it to say that there's some imagery in this action sequence and some choreography that I think is just delightful.
Yeah. And I think that's like the structure of the movie sort of speaks to the level of control that Rajamouli has over his movie, because again, he's not throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. He's very clearly like thought out and planned out what it is that he wants to show, and he knows exactly how he wants to show it. And I don't know, like, maybe we can talk about one of the very earliest action sequences in the movie, because it is exciting, but it doesn't give away too much. It just tells you enough about Beam in particular. So I'm thinking about the scene where we first meet Beam. He's in the middle of the woods. They're trying to trap an animal for reasons that will become clear later on in the movie, in which we will not spoil because they're great. And the animal they're trying to trap is a wolf. And what they get is a tiger instead. And so the movie sort of tracks Beam running through the forest at superhuman speeds ahead of this tiger that's chasing him. And throughout the entire sequence, even though you've never been in this location before, he's running from point A to point B in a way that makes you think like this is a long and kind of convoluted path. You never really lose track of who he is or where he is within the sequence. You also don't lose track of the tiger at all. The tiger's also completely CGI. I don't know if that's been made a ton of, but that's one of the hallmarks of this movie, is that every single animal is CGI, and there's actually a disclaimer at the beginning that says no animals were harmed because there were no animals involved in the filming. They're all CGI. Maybe that lends an additional like level of control over the film, perhaps. But I think that you get a really good sense for who Beam is as he faces off against this tiger, and the way that the camera captures him kind of looking at the tiger like on the eye line, and then also looking at the tiger on the tiger's eye line as well. But the camera isn't still, and it isn't moving in like the steady cam sort of swirling way that I think a lot of American directors would. The camera moves very fluidly as if it is the tiger in a couple of different places. And I don't know, I find that technique very fascinating, and it took a little bit of getting used to.
I like the camera work just in terms of the positioning and the way it moves during action sequences, and not just, you know, like the, you know, fight scenes, but also the dance sequences. It's so great. Like, Rajamouli knows when he needs to make cuts in order to build momentum. And he also knows when he just needs to let the camera either sit or, you know, move without cutting, just so we can kind of see what's going on. There's a late film. There's no dancing involved, but it's a musical number where one of the characters is undergoing an extreme trial and is sort of finding his inner strength in order to bear up under it. And the way that Rajamouli intercuts between the protagonist and the crowd that is witnessing this trial, and the other protagonist who is witnessing it as well from a completely different vantage point, is the way that he intercuts between those is perfect for really investing you in the scene and also getting you really hyped up to see some good old fashioned revolutionary action take place. It's also very inspiring in terms of the way that it makes the suffering of this protagonist clear without fetishizing it.
Mm.
So if you think about something like Braveheart, which I actually, you know, Braveheart, now that we know who Mel Gibson is fallen from grace a little bit. I do think that the filmmaking on display in Braveheart is very strong.
Mm.
But one thing that Braveheart does do is it's very much about the violence. Like it's the violence is bound up in the character's journey in such a way that they're kind of inseparable. Like you need to see all that blood because that's kind of what gives his journey its heft.
Hmm.
And what I appreciated about the scene that I'm talking about in RRR is that it is a violent scene. There is blood involved, but the way that the character struggles portrayed, it's not him, you know, powering through the pain. It's almost him transcending the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think is done solely through the way that Rajamouli uses his camera to emphasize certain details and the way that he uses cutting to, you know, make clear the other character's investment in that scene as well.
You make a really good point about the violence in Braveheart and also in this one. And I think part of it might have to do with those two, like these two movies' very distinct worldviews about suffering and about salvation, I think. I'm not going to pretend to know a ton about like RRR's specific viewpoint on salvation because I am not familiar with Hindu culture at all. So that's not my place to bring up, but it does feel very much like the suffering is not the point. And I think in Braveheart, the suffering very much is the point because that's the only way that you can achieve your ends and achieve your goals. And in this one, the suffering is just kind of a byproduct of the struggle, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah. And the ways that we learn about Raju's motivations also makes clear that he's sort of the fire. Big dichotomy brought up over the course of the film is that Bheem is like water, mm-hmm. and Raju's like fire. And Raju is definitely the much more violent of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And Beam's much more in tune, shown to be much more in tune with nature and a much gentler person in general. And I think the way that Rajamouli uses those two characters as foils for each other is an interesting way of portraying kind of the revolutionary struggle,
mm-hmm.
And kind of allowing us to sympathize with both of them while also recognizing that there are shortcomings to both approaches and kind of how complementary they are in coming together in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point too. Part of me wonders if Raju's choice of vocation has a little bit to do with that fire and that confrontational nature a little bit, like kind of approaching defeating, I don't know, like we're working against the British Empire as a revolutionary, but also using their same methods at the same time. I don't know. That's kind of a half-baked thought. It's something that came up.
There's a scene where he's writing back to his love back in his hometown, where he specifically mentions that he's working towards a certain goal, but he's not sure if it's right or wrong anymore, and he's being have doubts about whether employing the violent methods he has been, whether it's doing something to him and he's losing something in that process that he can't quite get back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really compelling question that I enjoyed mulling over when in the very few moments of the film where it kind of like invites you to sort of like be very quiet. And that's not a criticism, but I do think that there are some points of this film where I do kind of feel like maybe a little bit of restraint would have been nice to kind of, both allow me to sort of make these connections on my own, which is gratifying, but also kind of allow some more reflective moments to sit with the scale with which Rajamouli is kind of painting this relationship dynamic between these two protagonists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I think as I was watching this movie, I was very gung-ho about the entire thing, just like very much, yes, give me more. I want to see more and not really being at all that reflective about it. I don't know. I feel like it kind of, it swept me up in a way that I didn't fully expect it to. And at the same time, like, I was sort of primed for it, just given, like, the critical reception for this movie. And the more I think about it, with, like, the more distance that I've been getting from this movie, I kind of want to watch it again after having read up on a lot of the actual history and a lot of the actual context, so that I know that I understand it a little bit more, too. I don't know if, is that how you've felt about it?
I mean, I think that would be interesting. I'm not sure. Thinking about this film, I'm kind of, I feel like it, and this is maybe where I circle back to thinking of it as propaganda, is that I almost feel like that extra context would be interesting, but I don't know that it's necessarily integral to it working, because like many kind of propaganda adjacent works of art, like, the important thing is the emotional response that it engenders in you, and kind of the very clear simple stakes that it sets up, and that's sort of an integral way in which it functions. So having that extra context, I think, would help me appreciate it in a more complete way, perhaps, but I don't even know that would be necessary to appreciating it kind of as itself, if that makes sense.
I suppose so. I don't know. I could tell towards the end, there's some imagery that's being drawn on that feels very much of a kind with a lot of paintings from Hindu texts, that, like, I could tell that there was an allusion being made there, and I couldn't tell what exactly it was. And so maybe I was just emotionally, like, detached from the movie enough at that point that I kind of almost felt left out, not understanding what those allusions were. So I did go back a little bit, and Raju also goes by the name Ram, and his love back home, her name is Sita, and those are two avatars of Hindu gods. And so they're kind of drawing on, like, both his historical context and then also mythological context in a way that I found kind of interesting and wish I'd understood a little bit more of, like, as I was watching it. And at the same time, I can feel myself, like, trying to, I don't know, think about it so much that it almost boils down the meaning a little bit. So maybe you have a point about the getting caught up in the emotion or something, but I'm still curious, you know?
Well, if you have a chance to rewatch it with that extra context, I'd be interested to hear what you unearth from that experience.
Yeah.
But I guess that concludes our journey for purposes of this episode through RRR. Listeners, if you have a chance to watch this film, it's streaming on Netflix, so it's very easily accessible. We'd be very interested to hear anyone's thoughts who's had the chance to take that journey along with us. And, you know, if you have any impressions, obviously share that with us. We'd love to hear it. You can email us at seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com or tweet us at cbelievepod. We're maybe going to lean a little bit more into the bickering side of the buddy movie dynamic a little bit later on in the show with our discussion of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Don't go anywhere. We're going to lean more into the bickering side of the buddy movie dynamic a little bit later on with our review of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Welcome to The Conversation, the part of the show where we share what we've been hearing from all you listeners out there, keeping the conversation about movies going. So earlier in that segment about RRR, we were talking about this being sort of a dude's rock movie, like just something that's it's thrilling just to watch two guys just be the best bros they can be and engage in all sorts of action sequences. So you actually had a question that you posed on Twitter to sort of tie into that about what our listeners thought the most thrilling movie, like purely thrilling movie they've ever seen has been.
Yeah, and it's funny because I asked that saying just purely thrilling movie, and I think a lot of people interpreted that as most thrilling movie I saw in a movie theater, which is not a disappointing, like, way to go about it. I'm actually really glad of the answers that we got back from that. I just thought that was kind of interesting, and the more I think about it, I think the more thrilled I am, usually the darker the room is and the bigger the screen. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I would agree with that. It's been my experience.
Definitely. So we heard from a couple of people. So Lindsay Dunn responded back with, you've already gotten some killer options, which we will save for the ending. But she said, let's go with 36th Chamber of Shaolin. I love this zero to hero story with great martial arts. Lindsay, you've got me. I don't think I've seen any kung fu movies. Like, huge gap in my film education. So I think this may be a good one to start off with.
I mean, yeah, same here. I've seen kind of like, you know, the big ones. You know, I've seen like Bruce Lee movies, but mm-hmm. I haven't really seen, you know, some of the deeper cuts. So 36th Chamber of Shaolin's a blind spot for me as well.
It's a fantastic pick. Ron Sturi also responded with Star Wars, the 1977 one. I'm delighted that you said Star Wars and not A New Hope, by the way, Ron. While Return of the Jedi was a better movie overall, those of us old enough to experience the original were thunderstruck at seeing a film so wondrous and breathtaking, one that had never before been displayed on the big screen. It is still thrilling to me. And yeah, I can't argue with that either.
I mean, to be honest, if I were going to say, you know, my number one favorite answer to this question, it would probably be Star Wars A New Hope. Since Ron expressed it so well, I'm not going to make that my pick, but that movie just, I rewatched it recently just on a impulse, and it just, that original Star Wars, it just moves. It's just paced perfectly. You're mm-hmm. always, you're either onto the next action sequence or onto the next planet, and it's just, there's never a moment where you start like, even think to check your watch.
Yeah, that was one of the first live action movies I remember seeing, and I think it scared me. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
I can tell you specifically it was the garbage monster. It's called a Dianoga because I am a Star Wars nerd at heart. When the garbage monster's eye stalk pops up out of the water, I was just like, nope, absolutely not. And I was done with Star Wars for a couple of years after that.
It's a scary moment for sure.
Yeah.
We also heard from Joel Mayward, friend of the show. He's shared his picks with us in past episodes, but he just had four simple words. Mad Max Fury Road.
Witness me.
I mean, that's a great pick. Christy Olsen also said, you know, she chimed in. She said, came here to say this. Since Mad Max Fury Road is taken, though, I'll go with Mission Impossible Fallout, which is also quite a thrill ride, too.
It absolutely is. So I know you and Wade split on Mission Impossible Fallout.
Mm-hmm.
I am firmly, Wade, I'm with you on this one. If you are listening, I'm definitely on board with Fallout as being a very good movie as well as a good thrill ride.
I think so. When we get to our picks, which we're going to do, we should probably, before we do that, we talk about what constitutes a thrill ride. Mm-hmm. See, for me, when I thought about what movies I would use to answer this film, I have to think, like, what movies are just like from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like I can't catch my breath because I'm so bought in. I'm on the edge of my seat the entire time. Fallout, I think, has some really great scenes, but I don't find myself having that sort of I just can't wait for the next scene to happen experience with Fallout. It's more like, I'll rewatch this scene on YouTube a little bit later because it's really great in isolation, but
there's a moment midway through that movie where there's like plot twist, plot twist, plot twist, plot twist, like one after the other, after the other, after the other. And I think when I saw it in the theater, I was like punching the arm of my chair because I was so excited. So I beg to differ on the thrill ride aspects.
All right, well,
there.
You know, different strokes for different folks, but you do have a non-Mad Max, non-Mission Impossible pick. That would be your answer to this question.
Yeah, I do. So if Joel had not said Mad Max, I definitely would have said Mad Max. I adore Mad Max. But when I thought about it a little bit more, I think I'm going to have to go with Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity, which is a movie that absolutely terrified me when I saw it in the theater. I saw it in IMAX. I was lucky enough to see it on the big, big screen. And one of my greatest fears is being stuck floating in space with no tether. I know that that's not a realistic fear to have whatsoever, but it scares me anyway. And Gravity, I think, tapped into that and then also kind of got at, like, the thrill of touching like the face of majesty and not being able to fully understand it, but being able to process it at the same time as well. It's a great movie.
I mean, you know, my wife tells me that I'm not allowed to go to space because she is also very frightened about the prospect of just spinning forever into an endless void. You know, whether or not it's realistic that I will ever have occasion to go to space is an open question, but it's by no means an unusual fear, if that helps. My pick, I was actually surprised that nobody said The Matrix in answer to this question, because that would be my pick for this one. If I can't pick Star Wars New Hope, I would pick The Matrix, because that movie, I remember the first time I saw that, having never seen anything like it before, and just being constantly in awe, both because of the, you know, the kung fu is great, obviously.
Of course.
But also just the gradual unspooling of what the Matrix is and sort of kind of going on Neo's journey with him. I just, even when there's not an action scene going on, it's an utterly enthralling experience.
Oh yeah, completely agree with you there. That movie makes me want to like wear leather pants and sprint across a rooftop. And I know those two things are mutually exclusive, but like, I still want to do
it. You don't
it
think
anyway.
About it when you're watching the movie, and that's the important thing.
Definitely.
Well, listeners, if you have any thoughts, you know, we've shared some listener feedback already, but that doesn't mean the question is closed. So if you have any further thoughts about nonstop thrill rides that you would watch again and again, let us know on Twitter or over email. We'd love to hear those too.
So now we're going to go to the watch list, which is the part of the show where one host makes the other host watch a movie that they've never seen before, and then we talk about it. And usually there's some sort of a connection between the new release that we're talking about and the watch list movie that we're talking about. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. I think this one's a pretty solid one. So this week we are going to be talking about Shane Black's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which came out in 2005. And here's the official synopsis. Two-bit crook Harry Lockhart, played by Robert Downey Jr., stumbles into an audition for a mystery film while on the run from the cops. Winning the part, he lands in Hollywood, where he's flung into a tangled, murderous conspiracy with his childhood sweetheart, Harmony Lane, played by Michelle Monaghan. There's a Mission Impossible connection there. And hard-boiled private eye Perry Van Shrike, played by Val Kilmer. There's your Top Gun connection there. And this movie, I don't know, like, it feels like it connects with RRR on a couple of different levels. There's the kind of friction-y, but also like sort of bromance-y sort of partnership, I suppose, between the two main characters. There's also some over-the-top action in this one as well. So, Kevin, I'm curious, like, were there any other connections that you were thinking of with this? And also, does this movie hold up from 2005?
So, in answer to that first question, there's no real deep connection. I feel like you tend to play 10th dimensional chess with your connections in the watch list picks. This one, I was just like, I know the RRR is a buddy movie and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is a buddy movie. So let's suggest that one.
Cool. I'm overthinking it.
I was looking forward to revisiting this one because I hadn't seen it in a while. And so I was looking forward to the opportunity both to share it with you and also to just have an excuse to rewatch it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was bound to happen eventually with the watch list segment where I would heartily recommend something and be so excited to go back and rewatch it. And then upon rewatching it, realize that it's not quite as good as I remember it being. That said, I still like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's funny. It's got that Shane Black dialogue, which is its main attraction and still its main charm. Mm-hmm. But watching it, I remember just kind of the first time I saw it, just being blown away by how edgy the humor was, the way that Robert Downey Jr.'s Harry is both the protagonist and also the narrator. So there's a lot of, you know, tricks with breaking the fourth wall and sort of throwing in meta references to the Lord of the Rings movies. And that's a lot of fun. The first time I saw it, it was just so, it kind of blew my mind just how irreverent and fast paced and inventive it was. Watching it now, I don't know if it's because I'm just a little bit older, and so that sense of humor is just kind of not as right in my wheelhouse anymore, or if it's maybe just I've seen more films since I first saw it, you know, 15 years ago, and having seen more movies, maybe it doesn't seem quite as revolutionary as it did then. But I feel towards this film a little bit the way I feel about something like South Park, where you watch it when you're really young and it's just so edgy and funny. And then you go back and rewatch it and you're just like, this kind of is immature in some ways. And to be honest, there are parts of this film where the sense of humor went from being, you know, really edgy and, you know, pitch black to being a little bit, I hate using the word problematic as a straight up, like, this is bad because it's problematic. But to be honest, like, I felt a little bit uncomfortable with some of the humor with this film. Mm-hmm. And it didn't sour it completely for me, but it went from a film that I would full-heartedly recommend to anybody to being a little bit sort of like, I like it, but I'm a little bit more measured in my praise for it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I came away with on this viewing. It wasn't what I expected to come away with. Hmm. I'm really curious to know what you came away with, though, with your experience.
Well, first, I'm coming away with the fact that you used Lord of the Rings and Irreverent in the same sentence, and I'm just going to kind of, like, bask in that a little bit, because I think that's the first time those two, like, concepts have ever ended up in the same sentence before. I think I'm kind of along the same lines with you. I really like watching Robert Downey Jr. play like a dirtbag detective kind of wandering around L.A. I appreciate his performance especially, and also Val Kilmer's quite a bit. I think the leads here have some very good chemistry, and the dialogue, when it's really good, it's really good. This also feels very much of a time with 2005, where this movie kind of feels like it feels like it's being edgy by pointing out people who are not of the same identity as the person who wrote it. And it's kind of pointing them out and poking at them in kind of a way that feels like it's edgy because it's something that is unfamiliar, as opposed to it's edgy because it's actually edgy. And I'm referring specifically to Val Kilmer's character, who is named in the script as Gay Perry, which is both a terrible pun, and I'm a pun enthusiast, but also, it feels like a very regressive view of this one particular character's sexuality in a way where the script keeps calling attention to it in a way that just does not really jive necessarily with modern sensibilities in particular. That's not the only issue I have with it, but that's the one that really stands out to me.
I mean, Kilmer's character is interesting in this film because I think Kilmer is a strong enough performer that I think he pulls it off where it doesn't feel like he's just one walking gay joke. Mm-hmm. He feels more complicated, more fleshed out than that. I think that's a big credit to Kilmer. I think the writing on him is also, it's not nuanced, I would say, but it's good enough that it doesn't feel like the film is just sort of like, oh, isn't it crazy that he's a hard-boiled PI who is also gay. Like, I feel like that would be easy for a film to do. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what this film is doing with the character is a little bit better than that. It does feel very much like a 2005 sort of
it dances milieu. Up to that cat. It dances up to that, like, mode, I think, a couple of times, and it gets really close, and then it just sort of backs off a little bit. And the moments where it does back off from that mode are moments where I did respect the movie a little bit more. I also really respect Val Kilmer because he doesn't turn the character into a caricature, if that makes sense.
I think it's a really good performance. I'm on record as saying that I think both Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer have maybe never been better than they are in this film. I just think they're both so funny, and they both find notes to play that they wouldn't necessarily have to. I love a touch that Downey Jr. brings to a moment where he's in an apartment. He's just witnessed a man murder a woman, and when he confronts the man, he's holding a gun on him, and he shoots him. Mm-hmm. And in a lesser movie, it would be sort of like, oh, yeah, fine. Like, he gives the murderer his comeuppance. Like, this guy just killed an innocent woman, so he deserves to die. Downey Jr. plays the moment as horrible. Like, he kind of gives a glance down at the dead body of the woman before pulling the trigger again. And you can tell it's sickening to him both that he has witnessed this first murder, and it's also sickening to him that he is committing murder in his turn.
Yeah.
I think that's a wonderful touch, and it goes a long way towards making this film not just sort of like a, you know, an edgelord fest where it's just like, it's kind of about like, oh, ain't I a stinker in the writing. So I think all credit is due there. For me, I guess I was more uncomfortable with the film's attitudes towards women. Mm. There's a line, and it's a recurring theme is how, and this is kind of part and parcel of the satire of LA culture, where it's sort of like, it's, you know, everybody wants to be a star. Everybody comes out to LA to sort of make their fortune, be discovered, and most of them just aren't going to make it. And the way that this film maps that dynamic specifically onto women is that all these women are damaged goods. Mm-hmm. They're here because of some sort of sexual trauma, and they are, you know, they're enacting it in unhealthy ways, and it's kind of pathetic in the framing that this film puts it in. And that, you know, the first time I saw it, I saw that as kind of an essential ingredient in the satire and kind of also being part of its noir homage. Mm-hmm. Watching it now, it felt a little bit mean-spirited to me. And I don't know if that's just, you know, if that's just me here in 2022 having a different perspective, or whether that's genuinely a problem, but that was my reaction this time around.
It's funny because you get at the exact problem that I had with this movie too. So I don't think it's just like maybe necessarily just you in 2022. I think that my main problem with this movie is that we learn exactly why Harmony and then her sister, who also is kind of off screen, but plays a pretty crucial role throughout the course of the plot of this movie. We learn precisely why these two characters are messed up people. And we learn a lot of like sad, sordid backstory details about the both of them in a way that feels like it almost glances over it. Like it's a piece of color that needs to be there because we need to understand why these two particular women are, like, as the movie says, damaged goods. We never get that same level of detail for Harry or for Perry. You just don't get it. Their backstories are essentially blank slates. We know that one's a detective and one is a small-time crook. And that's all that you need to know about those characters. And I think I would respect this movie a little bit more if it had been willing to step back and give that same courtesy to a lot of its female characters as well. But it's not interested in doing that. And I think that it might be that Shane Black thought that he was, I don't know, giving these women like more of a backstory so that makes them more rounded. But to me, it kind of feels like it's playing the trauma card just for the sake of having trauma in a character's backstory in a way that didn't feel earned or necessary, just as a way to kind of like tie off a plot end on some level. And that just, it didn't sit right with me.
Well, it's instructive to sort of compare this film to the noir stories that it's very much explicitly dealing with. I mean, that Harmony, a key part of her character is that she loves these pulp detective novels that are all, you know, kind of the standard hard-boiled detective fiction where there's this private detective who plays by his own rules, and he encounters a succession of women who are in some way the classic fit into the classic noir archetypes, like the femme fatale or the honeypot trap. And it's, this film is kind of trying to dialogue with that in a way. But I think what's interesting is that if you watch a lot of these classic noir films, I haven't really read a lot of hardboiled detective fiction, but noir films, like a lot of the times the femme fatale is, she doesn't have to have some sort of trauma that explains why she's the way she is. She just kind of is that way, and you just sort of buy into it as that's the sort of universe that this film exists in. And I think this film kind of, it wants to kind of have its cake and eat it too, where it wants to have like these very simplistic female characters, but also kind of wants to complicate them. But that kind of just calls attention to how simplistic they are. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work quite as well, even though I don't think you can fully say it's misogynistic in just it despises these characters. Like Shane Black is obviously trying to do something with them, but I think it's kind of tacitly misogynistic in that it's not just interested in them as people, maybe.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it is also a credit to Michelle Monaghan's performance that I did still really like her character quite a bit, even though in places the writing just makes absolutely no sense to me. She is blasé where I think she should be a little bit more careful, and she's also careful where I think she should be a little bit more reckless. And like some of those ends of her character didn't quite meet for me necessarily. She feels a little bit more like a plot device than a fully realized character. Whereas you have Robert Downey Jr. and you have Val Kilmer just sort of bouncing off each other, trading barbs constantly. Like, I don't know. I could watch Robert Downey Jr. like tap out a cigarette and light it and like walk mournfully down an LA street nonstop. Would be very happy about that. I don't think you even need to tack on a movie to that. Just show me that film reel or that footage.
I think the movie's at its strongest when it's, like you said, just letting Kilmer and Downey Jr. just bounce off each other. There's just a joy in watching Shane Black write two men kind of just bickering with each other about nothing. Mm-hmm. I don't like his film The Nice Guys as much as I like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Okay.
But The Nice Guys has what I think is kind of a quintessential Shane Black moment where there are these two characters. I think they're also trying to transport a body.
Yes.
And, you know, while they're dragging this corpse around, you know, it's obviously just an insane situation. Instead of focusing on the task at hand, they're squabbling over the correct way to pronounce the name Baryshnikov. Yes. And I think that's sort of, that's Shane Black in a nutshell. And I think that's why his films are so much fun to watch sometimes is that dynamic is just endlessly entertaining. And I think that at its best, this movie kind of has those moments where Robert Downey Jr. At one point accidentally urinates on a dead body. And it's not innocent, but it's not something he does intentionally. And yet the stretch of dialogue where he tries to explain this to Val Kilmer's character is really funny because he's trying to explain it and Perry is not buying it at all for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And that's really enjoyable. And I feel like I would have loved the film to just stay on that wavelength forever.
It's funny because that particular wavelength, I think, got a little bit too puerile for me, honestly.
Like, oh, yeah?
That was a scene that didn't work for me.
Okay.
Yeah. What does work for me is the back and forth rapid fire of one, like, I mean, the dialogue where Robert Downey Jr. is talking to Perry about what happened, like that back and forth kind of works for me a little bit, like almost a who's on first, but grosser. But I think it's the two of them actively sniping at each other where they're both able to score points, I think, is what really works for me. So much of what Robert Downey Jr. is doing here is playing like kind of vulnerable and like helpless almost in a way. And he's great in those pieces. But where the movie really sings is where the two of them are just kind of going at it with each other or where he's going at it with Harmony. And again, this is the place where Michelle Monaghan's performance also really works for me is they get a couple of like lines of screamed dialogue back and forth at each other throughout a door. That's kind of a repeated motif throughout the whole movie. And each time I feel like you learn a little bit more about these characters' insecurities while they're talking to each other in a way that makes both of them more interesting and maybe a little bit more pathetic, but more interesting than pathetic, if mm-hmm. that makes any sense. So I'm also I'm a little bit mixed on The Nice Guys. I think I like it a little bit more than you do. And that's mostly on Ryan Gosling's performance mm-hmm. in particular. Like, the man can scream really, really, really well. I think there's a scene where he breaks into a bar that is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And it mostly just involves, like, a lot of the physical comedy that's going on. And there's some of that in here, too. But I don't think Kiss Kiss Bang Bang quite reaches those same heights that the physical comedy and the dialogue and the chemistry between the two main characters gets to in The Nice Guys.
I wonder, I think that maybe the thing with Black is he's kind of the key to a Black movie is just the craft of it. Like he's so mm-hmm. interested in just the funny things that you can do with language, the funny, the different ways that a character placed in a certain situation will react in a very human way that continually escalates the comedy in surprising and interesting ways. It's a little bit like watching a Buster Keaton movie where it's not so much about Buster Keaton pulling faces and being crazy because he doesn't do that at all. It's just he's just sort of doing these amazing stunts and capturing all these amazing amazing actions with the camera. And that's where the joy comes from, is just watching him do that and be amazing at it. And Black is sort of like the Buster Keaton of Odd Couple bickering.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's a scene in this movie where Perry and Harry have witnessed a body getting dumped by a lake. And one of them has to, like, Perry has to use his gun, basically, to in order to retrieve the body because it's stuck in the trunk of a car. And after the body has been retrieved and Perry and Harry are outside of the lake, just sort of bickering with each other, they both decide completely opposite, like, points of action that they need to take. Harry obviously does not want to be anywhere near the cops because he is a thief and he is wanted for various crimes and misdemeanors, whereas Perry's normal modus operandi is to go to the police because he is a private detective. And the two of them having the complete opposite decision made at the exact same time and then them bickering about how and why to go about it, I think works beautifully. It's also kind of summed up in Harry's decision to throw Perry's gun into the lake in order to hide the evidence, because he's not thinking several steps ahead with what the police are going to do once they have to start dragging the lake, and he also wants to get the incriminating stuff as far away from him as possible in as short amount of time as possible. And I think you get a lot of good information about how both of these characters, not just what their motivations are, but how they think about them in a way that kind of demonstrates, like, how they approach the world. And then you get some really good friction out of it. And I think it's that friction between the two of them where they're trying to reconcile their basically irreconcilable differences under a very high stress situation. That's just comedy gold. So that I appreciated very much.
I think that that's, and yeah, so much of comedy is about surprise. Mm-hmm. And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is so good at, you know, kind of making you see these little cliches and conventions that you've seen in movies and you just don't question them. Like, oh yeah, if you want to get rid of a gun, you just throw it in a lake.
Yeah.
And then so a character does that because he's seen the same movies that we have, and the other character points out how obviously stupid that is. And that's where the comedy comes from, is you're constantly encountering these little things that you take for granted, and Black is pointing them out and saying, like, well, that's silly. Why would you take something like that for granted? And that's really enjoyable. And I think that when the film does that as well with its satire of, you know, LA and just sort of maybe American entertainment culture in general, mm-hmm. I think the movie really sings. I think that maybe where it falls down a little bit for me here on this rewatch for me is that there are some assumptions that it maybe makes about women, mm-hmm. that aren't surprising. It's sort of playing into the same tropes that every other movie does. And it isn't maybe as smart about it as it thinks it is.
I feel like it does fall into the traps that it's trying to point out repeatedly. Like, there's a couple of scenes where, I don't know, Robert Downey Jr.'s character, very honorable man, which I appreciated very much. It was nice to have a dirtbag character who also wasn't a dirtbag with women necessarily. But he gets caught in kind of like a compromising situation with Harmony where she doesn't understand, like, what he's doing in the room that they're in necessarily. And he has, like, a valid excuse that is very, like, over the top and not really believable necessarily. And then once he's proven right, she just kind of accepts it as at face value and says, like, I trust you, even though even up until that point, she hasn't really demonstrated any of that trust. And I think it's that turning on a dime, like, you would expect her to still be upset by this situation, and yet she isn't. Like, there's a lack of character follow through, I think. And it's a kind of care that is taken with the male characters because they do have that very clear, like, through line of how they operate in the world that this character just doesn't. So, yeah, I'm on board with you.
Yeah, there. The process, I guess, is there's so much care lavished on the process of being a gumshoe for the men. And you kind of wish that maybe that same kind of interest in the process of being who Harmony is would have been evidence as well. Maybe.
Yeah, like I'm curious about the process of being a failed actor because that's what she is. That sounds like an interesting thing to explore a little bit too. One thing that I do want to explore is what is up with Shane Black and Christmas movies? And also, why have you made me watch two separate Christmas movies not at Christmas time so far?
I mean, I can't speak to the first one, like, mm-hmm. Shane Black, maybe he's just kind of a Scrooge at heart. who knows? Maybe Ebenezer Scrooge, had he been born in a different time and place, would have been making these sorts of movies. As for the second, I don't know. I guess I just like me a Christmas movie and get some holiday cheer even in the dog days of summer.
Liturgical calendar was made for a reason. I am anti-Christmas unless it is actively Christmas time.
Well, we can get into a whole discussion about whether the trappings of American Christmas are even the same thing as the liturgical calendar Christmas.
Fair point.
But there's only so much time in an episode of Seeing and Believing, so maybe we'll call it there. That was our review of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. If any of you listeners out there watched along with us, we'd be interested in your thoughts on this film. If you were exposed for it for the first time, or whether this was a rewatch for you, what your reaction was this time around. Very interested to hear your thoughts on that. Next week, we are going to be reviewing a film that I'm really excited about. Okay. I know you're excited about too, Sarah.
Yeah. I have been looking forward to this movie ever since it was first announced. It might be the movie I'm looking forward to the most this year. So we are going to be reviewing Jordan Peele's Nope, which I am extremely excited about. Cannot wait to watch it. Hopefully have a good conversation about it as well. And then pairing with it in the watch list. So we've watched a lot of horror movies this summer. And Nope looks like it's going to be on the horror thriller side of things. And I am not made of stone. I love a good horror movie, but I also want to balance it out a little bit. So I think we're going to branch out a little bit. So this one is kind of plays into that 10-dimensional chess that I like to play with All right. watch list picks. But the Nope trailer starts off with one of the characters pointing out that the first movie is of a black man riding a horse. And so I was thinking about getting into some of that maybe a little bit more forgotten, like left by the wayside film history, and maybe watch a movie about black cowboys. And so we are going to be covering Buck and the Preacher, which is a 1972 movie. It was directed by Sidney Poitier, and it stars him and Harry Belafonte, which is absolutely like a combination for the ages. This movie is accessible on streaming in a couple of different places. It's also coming out on the Criterion Collection later on this year. And this is also a watch list first, because I have also not seen this movie. So Kevin, you and I are going to go exploring together, and hopefully I'm not steering us wrong.
I'm all for that. I don't know how embarrassed I should be about this, but I had not even heard of Buck and the Preacher before you suggested for the watch list segment. So this is going to be completely virgin territory for me, and I am all looking forward for that.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week's episode. Seeing and Believing is brought to you by the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm your host, Kevin McLenathan.
I'm Sarah Welch Larson.
And we'll see you next week on Seeing and Believing.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.